In the Great Hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's four greatest heroes, created from the cosmic legends of the universe. Superman. Wonder Woman. Batman. Aquaman. And those three junior super friends, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog. Their mission, to fight injustice, to right that which is wrong, and to serve all mankind.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of For All Mankind, a Super Friends podcast. For All Mankind is a read-through show covering DC Comics' classic Super Friends series, which ran for 47 issues from 1976 to 1981. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me this episode is my super friend, Russell Burbage. Hi, Russell. Welcome back to the Hall of Justice.
Good to be back.
Thank you for being here. We're here to talk about Super Friends number 40. It was on sale October 23rd, 1980. The story is The Menace of the Mixed Up Senses. And we're going to talk about the issue, of course, and we're going to talk about the cover and all the and the backup feature and all the fun things in this comic. But first, we have to thank our sponsor. This episode of For All Mankind is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 45% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. Russell, what do you got?
Well, I went into InStock and I was looking for something kind of related to this comic. And so, of course, I started with the Super Friends, and both of the collected editions are on InStock and they're bargains. But I came across Superboy and the Legion of Superhero tabloid edition hardcover, which is the treasury size wedding of Saturn Girl and Lightning Lad. And you may think, why is that a choice on a Super Friends comic podcast? But it features the Time Trapper, who the Super Friends have fought on a couple occasions and will fight again. And it's got inks by Vince Coletta, who is the inker of the last few issues of Super Friends. And it features Princess Projector, who can control what you see and hear and feel, which is something to do a little bit with this story we're about to get into. So that's why I picked this story. It's by Paul Levitz, Mike Grell, Vince Coletta. It's 72 Colossal Boy-sized pages. Like I said, it's the wedding of Saturn Girl and Lightning Lad. They face the Time Trapper, and it's not normally $39.99. InStock Trades has got it down 55% at a bargain $18, $17.99. So go and get that if you haven't gotten it already.
Very nice pick. You told me that you were going to pick this, and I was like, what's the connection there? And you wouldn't want to tell me until we were on air. And so the first two are tangential, Time Trapper and Vince Coletta. I was like, okay. But then the other, that's actually pretty good. I like the whole Princess Projector thing. So that, yeah, that does tie into our story. So that's a nice pick. And of course, I will never knock anyone for recommending a treasury purchase. So of course,
yeah, I figured you wouldn't complain about that.
No, I'm on board with that. So very good. Since Wonder Woman in this story takes a little bit of the center stage, kind of not really, especially the cover, but I decided to go with something Wonder Woman centric. And in this case, it's Wonder Woman 77 and the Bionic Woman trade paperback featuring the great 70s team up between the sort of Linda Carter era Wonder Woman and, of course, the Bionic Woman. It's written by Andy Mangles and drawn by Judith Tondora. That features a marvelous cover by Alex Ross featuring the kind of image that you wish you could have seen in the 1970s. Two beloved actors teamed up there. It's 160 pages. It comes from Dynamite Entertainment. The normal price is $19.99, but InStock Trades is only $13.99. You save 30% off. So for these and all your other trade paperback needs, visit InStockTrades.com, and we thank them for their support. All right. As I said, we're talking about Super Friends number 40. It was on sale October 23rd, 1980. The story is Menace of the Mixed Up Senses by, of course, E. Nelson Birdwell, Ramona Fraiden. But this time, the inker is Kim DeMolder. Not Vince Coletta, my old instructor from the Joe Kubert School, Kim DeMolder. It's exciting to see his name here. He previously inked the Seraph story that we covered in Super Friends number 38, but here he's back doing the main feature. But before we get to the story, let's talk about this cover, of course, which you'll see in the gallery post. So, Russell, what do you think of this cover?
Well, I have to say it's not really one of my favorites. It seems a lot not going on in this cover, very static. And although I have to give Ramona points for putting all of the Super Friends on the cover, Bob Smith, the inker, doesn't really ink in Aquaman's legs. So it looks a little bit weird.
And oh, yeah. I just noticed that. That's right. Yeah, he's just kind of a head.
Of all of the things that we're going to see happen in this issue, like stampeding buffaloes and attacking cyclopses and whales and ships and things, it just is not the image that I would have picked to highlight this story. So, and Jack-O-Lantern there at the bottom is kind of like just, I don't know, he's in the way, sort of. I would have preferred him to be a little, you know, talking head like last issue's Zan and Jaina heads. I love the colors, the orange and the greens and the yellows kind of pop out, but I think is the best part of the story, or the best part of the cover.
I think all those criticisms are fair, but I love this cover, mostly because I just think it's drawn so beautifully. I agree. Yeah. Aquaman's head. I never noticed that until you pointed it out, that Aquaman, is just a floating head behind Superman. But I mean, first of all, this story beat is pretty minor in the story, which actually happened, last issue with Futurio, where the Super Friends are kind of, ignoring the threat of Futurio, and it makes it seem like that's a big story beat when it really is only like one or two panels. That's kind of the case here. Now, I don't know I don't think it was Ramona Fraiden's. I don't think it's hardly ever the cover artist's decision as to what image to highlight. I think that's what the cover graphic designer of any given comics company picks. So they probably tell the artist that this is what we want represented. So that said, I love the staging of this. I love that Ramona puts the camera slightly down towards the ground, and we're kind of pointing up a little bit. I love Wonder Woman's body language, is that she is rejecting this cop pushing her into the back of the van, because of course she's Wonder Woman, and she's like, you can't arrest me, I've done nothing wrong. And so all the figural work is fantastic. I love Jaina hiding behind Superman, like she's got her head tucked behind him, like it's the opening credits of Scooby-Doo. I just, like, she's afraid of what might happen. So all that I think is great. I love the orange sky. I love the horizon. If anyone who has seen The Fabelmans, in that final shot of that Spielberg movie, talks about why you want to put the horizon near the top or the bottom, but in the center, it's really boring. So as a composed image, I love this cover. I think it's very exciting. Again, doesn't really match too much what goes on in the story. And yeah, there were probably other things to more excitingly represent, like, as you said, like the Cyclops or whatever, but just as a pure piece of artwork, I absolutely love it. And I also love the fact that there is another guy in the paddy wagon that Wonder Woman is about to be dumped into. I do not want to be that guy, because she's going to be real mad having been stuck in there. So, like I said, I think it's just it's the kind of thing where if you were not a regular Super Friends reader and you were of a bent to like these characters, this is going to get you to spend 50 cents, I think, because it's such a great one.
Given all of my criticism, I don't disagree with anything you just said. It's not a bad cover. It's just kind of not my favorite. And I always, my eye is always drawn to that kid in the back with his arm up saying, yeah.
He's happy. He doesn't like Wonder Woman.
Why is he cheering Wonder Woman getting arrested? That seems so strange.
He's very pro cop, that kid. He's like, arrest them all. He doesn't care. Yeah. I don't know what's going on with that kid back there. But, so anyway, sorry. So that's the cover. And as I mentioned, the stories by Ian B, Ramona Fraiden, and Kim DeMolder. So Russell's already been on the show before, so we know his history with the Super Friends comics. So let's get right to the story. Superman and Aquaman are out at sea tending to a distressed ocean liner, except our heroes are a bit mixed up. Superman sees Aquaman ordering a whale to smash the ship's hull. Yet Aquaman sees the Man of Steel doing the smashing himself. What's going on here? After some more confusion, our heroes realize that their sense of sight has been tampered with. Little do they know that it's the work of the supervillain, the Monocle, who lured Superman and Aquaman out to sea so he could test his senses scrambler, patent pending. After we learn that the Monocle, as a young man, rebelled against his strict upbringing by inventing a machine that attacks the senses, he puts the next part of his plan into action, which results in total chaos. Batman sees a 50-foot Monocle in the street while Robin leaps on an attacking herd of buffalo, only to realize he has succeeded in jumping on the roof of a car. As if that isn't bad enough, Wonder Woman also falls victim to the Monocle's machine, resulting in what looks like the Amazing Amazon helping some bank robbers when she thought she was stopping a truck collision. The Super Friends meet back at the Hall of Justice, and after they figure out that the Monocle is behind all this, Batman hatches a plan, which involves arresting Wonder Woman. News of Wonder Woman's perp walk appears on TV, and the Monocle can't resist showing up in person to see it for himself. The Wonder Twins get the drop on the Monocle, followed by the remaining Super Friends, who shut their eyes and wear earplugs to fight off the Monocle's machine. They knock him out and have him arrested. Later, we see the Monocle at a psychiatric hospital where his doctor wears a monocle. All right. So that's the story of Menace of the Mixed Up Senses. So before we even get to the story, Russell, I do want to ask you, like, so I was looking at Mike's Amazing World, right? And trying to figure this out, because the Monocle as a villain is probably most famous to you and certainly to me as one of the participants in that classic JLA JSA team up from numbers 195 through 197. And in that story, he's established as sort of a Hawkman villain. Now, I was not familiar with him. Yeah, but he's from Earth 2. And I looked him up, and his previous appearance was Flash Comics number 64, which is, of course, a Golden Age story. And then he appeared in those JLA comics, which is after this. And he doesn't look like the Monocle we saw in those comics. That guy has like a purple suit and a kind of pencil thin mustache. So I'm guessing this is an Earth One or Earth Super Friends Monocle that he appears here and is never seen again.
Yeah, I noticed that too. I looked him up in Wikipedia or wherever, DC Wiki or whatever it is. And I realized that there were like two other Monocles. And this one was the second or third one, but he's not the most well known. As you say, the Secret Society of Supervillains or whatever it is, that the Ultra Humanite brings them together and fights the Justice League in about a year and a half after this story. And I often wonder if maybe Jerry Conway saw this and thought, oh yeah, that reminds me, the Monocle. Wasn't he an Earth 2 guy? I mean, we'll never know, but interesting.
Yeah, maybe so. We all know that E. Nelson Birdwell was a stickler beyond stickler for continuity. I mean, the man lived and breathed this stuff. Every character in Super Friends that ever shows up that has anything of any note, is given any name or any sort of distinctive characterization in any way, is probably from an old DC comic that he found. So I thought it was sort of funny that he took this villain. And again, I have not read the Flash Comics number 64 appearance. I don't even really have access to it as far as even if I can find it. So I don't know if that's what he looked like. The way he looks here is what he looked like in that comic. And then by the time he appeared in the JLA, he looks different. I have no idea. I don't know if George Perez has decided to redraw him or whatever. So we have no clue. I have no idea if this is meant to be the same guy or just E. Nelson Brittle was like, hey, Earth One or Two, sure, there's another Monocle. So why not?
Yeah. Well, I would intend to believe that, because I think I saw somewhere there's a profile of the Earth Two Monocle, and his name is not this guy's, right? This guy is Danton Graham or something like that. His name comes up somewhere in the story. And yeah, I recall seeing that the other guy was a crime boss or something, inventor or something else. So he did look like that, kind of the suit, the old classical Sandman type of idea that you wear a suit and a cape and then that becomes your superhero or your supervillain uniform.
Yeah.
I mean, it was the 40s. You could get away with less, right?
Yeah. He doesn't have a big M on his chest or anything like that.
Right.
He just looks like a regular dude. By the way, I mentioned credit wise, I did not mention it says here in the credits, writer E. Nelson Birdwell based on a plot by Nicholas Pascal. I don't know who that is. Again, as I mentioned, I'm not reading ahead. So maybe by the time we get to the letters page for this issue or like three or four issues ahead, they'll explain that. But I don't know who Mr. Pascal is and how he ended up co-writing this issue with Nelson Birdwell, but maybe we'll find out together. So the opening, as I mentioned, the opening scene is you've got Superman and Aquaman out in sea, and they both each see different things. It looks like that Superman is smashing the hull of the ship with his brute strength, and Aquaman is using a whale to do it. And they're both like, you know what? And I love that. So that once they kind of figure out, wait, why are you doing this? Well, why are you doing this? And they realize, all right, something's up. They look and they see the captain of this ship, and they go, Superman points, he says, look, Aquaman, he says, is he or is he not wearing a monocle? You hardly see anyone wearing a glass eye these days. And Aquaman's like, maybe he's eccentric, but that's no concern of ours. Kind of like already like, he's fishy looking. Like what? Just because he has a monocle? Like, that seems a little harsh, guys.
Yeah, but I noticed that it was a little bit heavy-handed that he does that way. And then, of course, it leads you into seeing him in every other iteration, too.
Right.
But it's like, okay, come on. That's a little bit too many seconds screen time for that one guy. You're like, yeah. Oh, look at this.
Yeah. But, I mean, any story that opens with Aquaman, like, I'm happy. You're like, okay, he's getting more to do. So that's cool. So then we did, of course.
Well, hold on, because in this bit, I always wondered, every time I reread the story, I wonder, what are Superman and Aquaman doing? Why are they together? You know, there doesn't ever say they suddenly, you know, see each other acting odd, but are they just hanging out? Or are they on their way, you know, Superman on his way to Atlantis just to have lunch with Mira and the kids? Or what's going on?
Aquaman being in the sea isn't an unusual event, but yeah, why is Superman there exactly? They don't, it's not like the ship is sinking and they're trying to rescue it and then Superman smashes it, makes it worse, or Aquaman smashes it, makes it worse. It's like, wait, why you guys were out? Why are you even sort of bothering the ship in the first place? But
right, exactly. I love that second page where Superman's all in your face, like, what the heck are you doing? And Aquaman says, me? Have you lost your super mind? I clearly thought you do it. It's like, go on, Aquaman. Don't take any gruff.
Yeah, exactly. I'm tired of Superman with Bigfoot and everybody. I love that he's got his fist out. He's like, I'm angry at Aquaman. Like, all right, calm down a little bit. So again, they figure out, okay, something's messing with our senses. So let's go check this out. And then we get the origin of the monocle. And he talks about that he lived this kind of very restricted life. His parents were very, very kind of strict on him. And so he was rebelling by experimenting with science and turning it. Now, why that would lead you to create something with a monocle, I don't exactly know, but that's okay. It doesn't really matter. And then we see that some of the stuff that he's caused, and there's this scene of like utter chaos on a city street where we see there's a woman wearing a trash can on her head. There's a guy kicking a building. There's a cat chasing a dog. There's a woman on all fours, like booping a dog with her nose. There's what looks like a homeless guy giving money to a guy who's in kind of a nice suit. So it's goofy. It's just real goofy because you're like, this isn't so much chaos. It is just opposite day here in this city. But, you know, it's okay.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite scenes right there with the ladies on her legs, you know, talking to the dog and the mouse is chasing the cat. But I was wondering, because I have a comment about Gleek later. It's like, did he really try this monocle on animals? Does it really work on animals? Or is he just kind of imagining that it would happen? Because we never see any animals actually get affected. Hmm. And when Jaina turns into an animal, she's not affected. Of course, she's got a kind of a excuse for that. But still, it's like, well, I wonder if that happens. I really love that bottom panel where it's a extreme close-up of his eye and his brain thing. And this man is stark raving crazy.
It is a funny panel to see, like, just the eyes and the hairline with the captions over them. It's got a slight Mad Magazine energy where it's just really goofy. Like, there's all these little things just going on. You're like, what? You know, it's just like, oh, okay. So then they said Batman and Robin show up. Batman sees a 50-foot monocle. And Robin's like, what the heck are you talking about, Batman? And then, of course, Robin sees what he thinks are a cowboy and a herd of buffalo. And he grabs one of them and wrestles it. They're actually like bison, grabs their horns and wrestles it to the ground. And then there's some guy like, Robin, stop clowning around. And he sees that all Robin has done is grab the hood of a brown car. So that's all it's going. So everything it says, again, it has a very Mad Magazine energy to this particular story.
Yeah, I love the page where we get the half page of the Cyclops. That really works for me, that it shows the height of the 50-foot man that Batman and Robin are in the lower bottom, and it's looking up at him. You don't see that too often in these sorts of books, so I really like that point.
Yeah, it very much conveys the height of it and stuff like that. So we see Batman tries to attack the monocle. And this monocle, by the way, has no eyes. He just has a monocle in the center of his face, which is, again, a little like kind of creepy looking. Batman tries to knock him out. It does the best he can. He smashes into the glass and he realizes that he has not smashed the monocle. He has actually just broken through the window of a building. And I love the classic cleaning lady with the mop and the bucket and the kind of apron. Like, it's just out of like a, again, like a 1940s movie. And Batman's just like, sorry, ma'am. And he just heads back out the window. It's a very Adam West Batman kind of beat. So then we follow Wonder Woman, and she is, she's with the Wonder Twins. She is running around and trying to stop this. And she sees what she thinks is a truck and bus collision. And she stops the truck from going. And what everyone else sees is her smashing into the truck and helping these bank robbers steal the loot out of the truck. Meanwhile, the Wonder Twins are trapped in these little fire and sort of glass cases, kind of cube sort of thing, and they can't stop her. And then they get out of those when Wonder Woman shows up. There is a profile. This is page 12, I think. Is it 12? I'm looking close at the page number, but it's the bottom panel. I'll have this in the gallery on page 13. Excuse me. There is a profile of Wonder Woman where she's like, "Great Hera, they are disappearing mysteriously as they appeared." That profile just makes me like, the looseness of it just cracks me up. It's such a beautiful little drawing.
Yeah, that's cool. The art in this is beautiful everywhere, and I got to say it's one of Ramona's greatest works. But the story doesn't make any sense, and the idea that the two Wonder Twins aren't in the same type of cage, I never understood that. It's like, why? What's wrong with a solid glass case to put them both in, right? Or
yeah, I know.
Put them both separately in or something. It's like, well, why is that separate? And, you know, why is the monocle doing this whole thing at all? That, I think we'll get to that at the end, you know, because the Super Friends themselves asked that. But I'm like, why is he going to all this trouble? This was the point in the story where I was thinking, what's he doing? What's his long game here to do all this stuff for them?
Some people just want to watch the world burn, Russell. You took a moment to talk about the art. Let's talk about the art. As I mentioned, it's inked by Vince Coletta has the month off. He was inking 17 other books at that week. And so instead, we've got Kim DeMolder. And this is very early on in Kim's career. I mentioned that I had him as my instructor for several different years at the Joe Kubert School. Great guy. We had a lot of fun together. He was a great instructor. And I think he does a great job. I agree with you. I think he is actually a very good inker for Ramona. He adds a little more feathering to it than Bob Smith. Bob Smith has a very clean line. Kim DeMolder's is not quite so much that, but it's way more fluid than Coletta's. And so it makes for literally a quite attractive package. And there's even a little more kind of, personality in the faces. I think because again, I've been complimentary to Vince Coletta on the months where I thought he did a great job, but his faces when he inks someone tend to be very inexpressive to me, my opinion. Mm-hmm. They're just like very reduced down to their barest, but like the panel on page 14 where Batman says, "I have a plan. It's going to involve Wonder Woman getting arrested." The look on his face is fantastic. Like he has this like jaunty little, you know, Wonder Woman is arrested. It's more personality you would typically see almost out of Batman. And so, yeah, I think they're a really nice pair. I really like DeMolder's inks on Ramona Freyden.
Yeah, I think they look wonderful together. The other thing I wanted to call out is the coloring, because in this whole sequence, you can get a sense of depth. The audience, the people who are watching the robbery, mm-hmm. Are all in like blue or dark, and mm-hmm. they're shown to kind of give the depthness of that. Oh, there's a couple of things going on here. You can see them. They're not important, but they're actually important to the kind of the flow of it. So I love that they're all colored very, very, well in that sense. Jerry Serpe.
Yeah.
He did a great job.
Yeah, I agree. I love getting the use of foreground and background. It's really, really sharp. So yeah, it makes for a really, you know, nice image. So then we cut to the TV news story, and we're seeing that Wonder Woman is going to be subjected to a perp walk. And they, you know, the whole reason this plot works is because they figure that the monocle is such an egotist that he has to show up in person to watch it when he could just watch it on television. It would be just as good, But,
you skip that whole scene where Superman and his super memory remembers the guy with the monocle, right?
Yes, so yes.
That whole bit, and it made me laugh because it's like, okay, when did Aquaman and Superman have their whale ship experience? Like a day ago? Or I don't know. A month, a year? Because he's like, well, my super memory will be able to make a sketch of the man. And I'm like, dude, it was yesterday. Okay. You don't need your super memory on something that just happened yesterday or this morning, for all I know.
Superman, you don't have to put the word super in front of every basic thing that anyone does. Yeah. You know,
he's been hanging out with Batman too long.
Yeah. So I like that he draws the monocle on a chalkboard. I love that the Super Friends have an old fashioned chalkboard in the Hall of Justice.
Well, and then the other thing on that page is if you blink and you miss him, that's the one appearance of Gleek in this story.
He's sitting on the floor there. That's right. Yeah, he's really not in this one.
Why isn't he around? I would have liked to have seen. I mean, I can understand if he wasn't out training with Wonder Woman and the twins, but at this point when they stage, you would think that, well, maybe we'd like Gleek. Maybe he could help us if the image inducer doesn't affect him or, you know, something. But
he took out the time trapper, so, you know, he can be quite effective when you need him to be. So we're now down in in sort of the main drag of Gotham City, and there Wonder Woman is in fact getting handcuffed and perp walked into the thing, and we see the Super Friends all standing there watching this. The Wonder Twins are in their little cages. Again, they're sort of faking those, and then they turn into a form of a, what is it? Spamuro? Is that how you, Gramuro?
Gramuro.
And, Zan turns into a large wave, and then, they manage to take out Monocle, pretty easily, actually. They take him up and they knock him over. And that gives the Super Friends time enough to approach and, you know, talk about, you know, like gilding the lily. You've got a guy who has no powers other than this monocle, and you've got Superman, Batman, Robin, and Aquaman all charging him at the same time. You know, you're like, wow, I don't think we need all four of you guys to handle this. But again, they've got plugs in their ears and their eyes, and Batman and Robin take them out. Superman, uses his X-ray vision to take out the sense tampering machine. And then of course Wonder Woman is out there because she wasn't really arrested. So my question to you, Russell, is are the cops in on this or what? Because she's just all of a sudden she's there. So were the police part of this scam, or did she actually turn herself in?
Well, I would think they'd have to be part of the scam because really there was no money stolen, right? Wasn't, or did I misread the story?
Well, but we can't tell. But I mean, we can't tell by what anybody sees. So maybe the cops think the money really was stolen.
Well, maybe, but I would think that they could figure out that there was no armored car on that time at missing, you know, millions of dollars. My guess is that they were part of it, and it's Gotham, right? So I think Batman just called up and said, "Hey, Chief O'Hara, show up and throw Wonder Woman in the paddy wagon for us, and we'll." I'll
speak
to you later.
Saints big water, Batman. What are you talking about? So we end, and normally the Super Friends comics end with kind of, the villain being defeated. And the last panel is generally the villain in custody by the Super Friends and they get some sort of line. But here we get a slight variation of kind of the Batman villain being tucked away in Arkham Asylum. We're here. He's at a psychiatric hospital. We don't get any sense that it's Arkham necessarily. It actually looks kind of a little bit nicer than what you would see in Arkham. But we see that the Monocle psychiatrist is wearing a monocle, and that just sends Monocle into hysterics. And that's the end of the issue and the end of the story, at least I should say, and the end of this version of Monocle. Basically, you'd never be seen again.
Yeah. Well, and I kind of thought he was worth seeing again. I mean, he was kind of. It's kind of like the calculator or one of those one-off guys that if you could think of a story for him, he could come back. I mean, Batman and Robin and all of them would if they saw or sensed a man in the crowd with a monocle, he'd say, oh, the monocle's back. So if he probably shouldn't be too as obvious as this. But I always thought, you know, like the illusion powers, he got away with everything until he overplayed his hand. So he could have come back and been – you know, pretty strong bad guy.
He feels very, like I mentioned earlier, with the scene with Batman going through the window, he feels very Batman 66. Like it, that feels like a villain that they could have had. Cause I mean, he's not wearing a costume. So he'd kind of be cheap to do. And he's just a guy with a monocle. Like, you know what I mean? Like that would be kind of a simple thing.
he looks a little bit like Rudy Valley in some of these pictures.
He does. I thought that, God, you and I are so old because I thought the same thing. He does kind of look like Rudy Valley. Who the hell knows who even that is anymore? So, all right. So overall in this story, who do you think came out best, Russell? Who would you say is the best friend if there's even one to pick?
There's not really an overwhelmingly strong character in the story, but, I would probably give it to Zan just because he knocked the guy down and was kind of able to do it. But before I do that, I would just give a caveat that the Wonder Twins getting out of their cages and being mistaken by that, that's a huge mistake on the Monocle's part. And that you would think that you would be smart enough to know that the boy is the water and the girl is the animal, or put them both in something that'll, you know, keep them. It's like, what? That's stupid. And then the idea that Xena is some space alien monster that we've never heard of before. I really hate that. That one panel at the top of page 16 where she says, oh, I'm a Grimmer, which can, you know, doesn't have normal senses and I can do this, that, and the other, and I can save the Super Friend's ass. It's like, come on. Couldn't have thought something a little bit more clever. That's why I kind of mentioned earlier the cat and the dog and the mouse. It's like, if the animals, if she had turned into something and realized, oh, it doesn't affect animals, then it would have been still the same thing. And maybe Zan is the wave and her is a tiger or something would have taken him out. I mean, I think that would have made more sense to me anyways. 13, 14-year-old Russell would have liked that better.
Some of these stories lately in the last couple issues, I do feel are a little rushed. Like I mean, they're the same length as the Super Friend stories were before, but they feel a little rushed. And I am curious as to, I know the DC, all comic book nerds know that DC had this big marketing push that when the books went to 50 cents, all these books got backup features, and that was kind of the selling point. And of course, you know, as of a couple issues ago, every issue of Super Friends has a backup story, right. Except for a couple where they promoted. But I always wondered, like, this would have been the kind of, maybe the monocle isn't enough to carry much longer than this, but it does feel so abbreviated that I'm like, they probably could have done without the Jack-O-Lantern story and expanded this by a couple more pages just to make the monocle a little more of a threat and a little more not quite so easily suckered into, you know, that kind of thing. But I don't know.
I would have liked that.
Yeah. So yeah, I think, Zan probably just because he takes out. I mean, I always feel like Batman just because he comes up with the plan, you know, from the cover, you think it's going to be Wonder Woman. You feel like she's going to be central to the story. But as we just learned, the whole taken away in the paddy wagon thing is like two panels. That's it. That's the whole bit. So it really was kind of a bait and switch on the cover, at least. And then villain wise, the monocle, as we've already talked about, he went on to other appearances. He got a who's who listing even. And, his appearance in JLA 195, 197 is like, that's one of the great JLA JSA team ups of all time. And he actually, you know, for a guy with a relatively simple power set, he just has a monocle that like does stuff. As drawn by George Perez and written by Jerry Conway in that story, he seems fairly formidable. So I liked him a lot in that story.
Yeah. So I have a question for you. Do you have the actual issue in front of you, or do you have like the one of the collections or on the?
I have it as scans. Look, I'm looking at it on my computer.
Okay. Well, because at the bottom of the page, the last page is not a full page.
It has that ad. Yeah. The coming super attraction. Yeah.
And it says currently on sale October 9th, Superman 2020. And he faces the destruction of New Metropolis. So I'm wondering if they had like COVID coming in that time.
I don't even remember that feature. I really don't.
I don't either.
Yeah.
I didn't read a whole lot of Superman stuff at that time. I read DC Comics Presents. I remember this Superman and the Spectre team up that they're featuring, but I don't think I read that Superman story.
It's interesting that they chose to, and this has been happening the last couple issues, is devote the bottom third of the final page to an ad. And it's all Superman comics too. Like it's not Batman. Again, probably underscoring that Superman was a movie star at the time. Mm-hmm. And like he was the big draw, not Batman at this point. So, okay, we got to promote our line of Superman titles. But maybe the story could have used a couple, you know, just a little more space.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
So, all right, let's go on to the backup feature, which I mentioned is Jack-O-Lantern. The story is called Blarney for Sale. So Ian V leaning really heavily into the whole Irish thing. Again, it's by E. Nelson Birdwell, of course, Romeo Tangal and Kim DeMolder. Daniel Cormack, a.k.a. the Jack-O-Lantern, or just Jack-O-Lantern, I guess, gets involved when his friend Seamus O'Mara, a struggling farm equipment salesman, gets taken in by a local crook who sells him a piece of the fabled Blarney Stone, which gives O'Mara the gift of gab. Using his powers as Jack-O-Lantern, he exposes the crook's plan and helps Seamus get a little bit of confidence. Not only does Seamus start selling stuff, but he finds the gumption to finally propose to his girlfriend, who says yes. All right. I have a tough time with these Jack-O-Lantern stories. I don't know.
Yeah, I hate the story. I'm like, first of all, I'm not Irish. So I'm like, what is a Blarney Stone? I'm like, okay, the only thing I know about it is like from the story, but it's evidently some talisman or something. You kiss it for good luck or something. It's not really explained.
That's exactly what you're supposed to do. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he gets it, but he doesn't really have it. And it's one of those things like, oh, Dumbo with the feather that it's not really the feather that's making him fly. It's his self-confidence type of stories. It's like 8 or 9 pages for that. I mean, I would have preferred Owl Woman or Impala or one of the other Global Guardians to this. I just didn't enjoy it at all.
I love Jack-O-Lantern's look. I love his power set. I love the little Halloween basket that he carries with him, which I know is a Jack-O-Lantern. But I mean, like, I love everything about how he looks, what he can do, all that stuff. But the minute that little elf shows up in these stories, my head just falls. I don't like elves in stories. Like I did to me, the minute there's like a little magical elf that shows up in things, I just go like, ugh. And there's just I think Jack-O-Lantern is actually really cool looking. I like that he's got this helmet that has no facial features. You know, like it's kind of imposing. I like the color scheme, the purple and the blue cape and the kind of pirate boots. Like everything about that is cool. But the two stories so far that E. Nelson Bridwell has given him to do, I'm just like, oh God, no. So I'm like, look, you did Seraph, do him again. I know he's going to come back, and I know that Ian B is trying to rotate through the Global Guardians, but as you pointed out, do Owl Woman. Give me, you know, do some of the other characters. Why? Like, visually, I think it looks cool. I'm fine with Romeo Tango and Kim DeMolder, the pencils. That's cool. I love the little cartoon hearts that float over the girl's head when.
Was going to comment on that too. It's like by the time we get to the end of the story and there's little floating hearts over it, I was like, okay, no, let's come on, wrap it up. Let's get out of here.
Yeah. But just that little elf, every time I see him, he's just like, oh, Jack-O-Lantern. I just oh God, no. So I it's ridiculous to be too hard hearted about a comic book published, 35 years ago that was meant for children. And I'm a 50-year-old talking about it, but it's like I want to like Jack-O-Lantern so bad. I can't quite get that. But now, I liked this one more than I liked the other one, because the other one was even more with the elves and all this stuff and leprechauns and all that kind of stuff. This one's got at least a little more of like a human interest kind of thing that he uses his powers to help people in his town. But like, it's just, there's like a crook and he's going to sell the Blarney Stone to this guy. And you're just like, what are we doing here? So yeah, please. Give us some other Global Guardians. There's lots of other. Give me a Timberwolf story, something, for the love of God. So yeah, I just kind of a Jack-O-Lantern to me is 0-2 in this particular run of Super Friends. So now,
so that's when you said Global Guardians, that reminds me of a mildly interesting anecdote I have. Before the DC,
we'll be the judge of that.
Yes, you will. You will. I will be. I'm throwing myself out there. before that, DC Comics Presents issue where Superman teams up with the Global Guardians, I don't think there was a name for them. They were just the International Heroes, right? So I think somewhere around this time, I put a couple of them together and wrote up my own little story.
Wow. And
I called them the League of Nations.
Nice.
And frankly, frankly, I like that name better than Global Guardians.
I mean, Global Guardians,
if that's right or not.
I mean, Global Guardians has the alliteration, which is always helpful, but League of Nations is fun. It's clever. You know, it's a play on real life events, and it's got the word league in there. So yeah, I like that. They probably can't copyright that. That might have been the problem. You know, if they'd ever come with it, you can't copyright that. So, but I like that. That would have worked. The Justice League of Nations or something. Justice League International, perhaps. But yeah. So, I mean, I know for a fact it says right here at the bottom next month is Seraph. So I'm excited to get to that because I like that first Seraph story so much. So now normally this would be the end of the issue. We generally haven't been talking about the letters pages a whole lot just because there haven't been anything terribly notable going on. But this one, there's one letter in here that I thought was interesting and I wanted to read to everybody. So let me just, it's short. So let me read it. It says, Dear E. Nelson and Company, I cannot clear the sour taste after reading Superfriends number 35. Yes, there were some good things about it, but the bad things stuck out. First, the cover. It was nice, with interesting colors and an eye-catching scene. Unfortunately, the heroes and the shadow of the villain were too big, and Aquaman had to be pushed off. If Ramona were to draw them a little smaller, they could have fit the entire team in there instead of always eliminating Aquaman and Robin. The story, like the cover, could have been great, but was instead only acceptable. What began as a novel idea became bogged down with nitpicky word balloons, question marks on every other page, and exaggerated strength. Come on, do you really believe a strong man could punch a criminal so hard that he'd go through a wall designated safe for the storage of money? It's bad enough Superman can do it. But I think what I hated most about this tale was the proverbial vengeful arsonist. It was a real letdown. There were a few good things, though. Commissioner Gordon, Aquaman's diving, and as I've already said, the idea of a circus. Unfortunately, these pluses could not overshadow the minuses, and I give this issue a 5. You can do better. Signed, Russell Burbidge.
Yeah, I had my angry pants on from a young age.
You certainly did, young man.
But hey, points for being an Aquaman booster, right?
You were OG, man. I never had letters published when I was your age, when I was the age here. So you were carrying the torch for Aquaman long before me, which I very much appreciate. But so you got your letter published. How many letters did you send into Superfriends regularly?
No, I don't think too regularly, every once in a while. Sometimes when something really bothered me, like this cover, if you remember the circus of the crime or whatever it was called, when the non-professional superheroes took the place of the super friends, that was the issue I'm talking about. And the cover was gorgeous with this kind of beige, sandy yellow background color, but Aquaman wasn't on there. And so it was just one of those things that, like, again? Mm-hmm. And so for some reason, I just took pen to paper, but I'll never forget. I picked up this issue and I read it and I didn't particularly care for the story all that much, as we've all heard. And I hated the Jack-O-Lantern story. And then I read the letters pages because, you know, I just used to, I did. And I get to this and I'm like, what the hell? And I can remember thinking, they printed my letter. This is me. And this is the third most important comic book in my entire collection. So first of all, the first most important comic to me was the first comic I ever remember reading, which was Justice League of America 112, where the superheroes fight Amazo. My best friend at the time picked it up somewhere on his trip and brought it to school and showed me. And I was like, what is this? Aquaman, who is this? Who are these characters? And it had beautiful Dick Dillon and Dick Giordano art. And I was like, I need this. So I ripped the subscription page out and I went to my dad and he wrote a check to DC Comics National Periodical Publications, and I started my subscription to Justice League that week.
Oh, so that's nice job, Dad. Good on you, Mr. Burbidge.
Then, about a year or two before this, there was Teen Titans number 52. And if you remember reading the letters pages in the 70s, a lot of them, they had letter column contests. And lo and behold, I sent in a design and it was chosen for the Teen Titans letter column. And of course, it only lasted 2 issues before the comic was canceled. But if you find a copy of Teen Titans from 1977 or so, number 52, now by now there's been so many different versions of Teen Titans, it's hard to find, but it's the one with Robin and Batgirl, the Silver Age Batgirl and somebody else attacking Mr. Esper or whoever it is from Thumb Buckler and Giacoya cover. My name and my design is on there, drawn by Terry Austin. And it's a beautiful work. It was my idea was all these superheroes, the Teen Titans in stamps on the side of a letter. And Terry Austin redid it, and it's beautiful. And it was in that issue, and then the very last issue, number 53. So that proved that I had a design sense, and I felt really, you know, validated and vindicated that my imaging, my ability was good. My art they didn't use, but my idea they did. And then here, I opened this issue, and they've got a letter from me. And I thought, okay, so I'm good at getting my thoughts across, and it's mildly entertaining. I don't know if I think I exaggerated it a little bit to be printed, right? But this is the first letter I ever got printed. And then about a year later, I got my printed in the issue with Starro versus the Justice League when Starro's on the top of the Empire State Building.
JLA 190.
Oh, I'll take your word for it, but it's Starro on the top of the Empire State Building.
Or 189. He's actually in both covers. You probably right, 189. Yeah,
but not the one with all of them with Starro on their faces. But
okay,
the one
so that's 189 is part one. Yeah, that's okay.
And I lead off the letter column. My letter is the first one. And I'm like, oh my God. I think I wrote some, not too often, certainly not as much as like the other names that
TM Maple or TM Phoenix or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't write as often as that, but I wrote every once in a while. And I had a couple letters printed in World's Finest because it occurred to me that instead of writing on about like a whole issue, just write on one of the features. So I wrote about Hawkman and Hawkwoman. And I think I had like two or three letters printed about that series. So this was my first. So you never forget your first.
You never forget your first. Were these handwritten or did you have like a typewriter?
No, I would have handwritten them at this point.
Okay. All right. So. It's impressive. I wrote a few letters and I never got any printed. So, good on you, man. That's now I said props to ENB for printing a negative letter. Cause you scorched the earth behind you here on this letter. And then his response is, as long as it's a 5 out of 10, Russ, not out of 100. So he smiled nervously and moved on to the next letter. Cause he was just like, okay, fine. But yeah, there you are, man. There you are. Very impressed. Now, you must have shown this to your parents, right? They probably were pretty impressed.
Yes. Yes. I showed it to them and I showed it to all my friends who liked comics, the two or three other people I knew at the time. And in fact, I showed this to Ramona Fraden because a couple of years ago at the New York Con, she was there and I brought a couple comics for her to sign. And this was the first one I gave her. I said, hey, this one, I know this was your last issue and we'll get to that in a second, but, I'd like you to sign it because I wrote the letter. And so she opens it up and she starts to read it. And this is what we're talking about, how she hated Vince Coletta, working with Vince Coletta, and how E. Nelson Bridwell never printed letters praising her art. That's when she started talking about it. It's like, oh, yeah, you go off on me because I didn't do the, I didn't include Aquaman or Robin. You know, he never printed anything nice about my art. And I was like, and of course, obviously, I felt really bad.
Should, Russell.
13-year-old Russell. Not telling her that she should draw smaller.
here I, 7-year-old Russell Burbage, am now art directing Ramona Fraden.
But she got a good big kick out of it. She's like, yeah, I enjoyed that series, but then Vince Coletta was assigned and I just didn't want to do it. And Brenda Starr came up. And so we also mentioned in this letter column is that, you know, Ramona Fraden moves into the world of newspaper strips to take over the art on the very popular Brenda Starr. Mm-hmm. We wish her well and hope she'll find time to do an occasional Super Friends as a guest penciler. And I don't think she ever did, but yeah, this was her last issue. So that talk about letdown, bittersweet.
Well, I mean, okay. Now I, again, I've not been reading ahead, but according to Mike's Amazing World, she draws the next one. She draws number 41. So we'll have to check that out. I don't know. She's credited here with Vince Coletta. So maybe, I mean, there's obviously a bit of a drag between when they're writing these letters. So maybe she already had one more in the hopper when E. Nelson Bridwell wrote that. And she continued to do the covers, but yes, she's not long for the book at this point, which is a damn shame. Because she's a genius, and despite what you said to her, she's a great, great artist. I like Romeo Tango, but he's no Ramona Fraden, at least when it comes to Super Friends. And, you know, as we know, the book is headed towards cancellation anyway. We're only about 6 months out from the end of the series anyway, but that's impressive, man. It really is. I remembered, especially JLA, man. I remember buying that comic. I have the same copy that I bought off the stands in 1981 or whatever. And it would have been 81. And so, you know, it's weird to think that, a name that I saw on that letters page, I would end up being friends with decades later. That's a weird time's a flat circle. Yeah.
So, well, if you remember the issue with, the Red Tornado gets cloned or whatever it is by Teal Morrow and he fights the Justice League, that great cover by George Perez.
Absolutely.
I've got a letter in that issue too.
Man, you were on a roll.
When I was going to do this podcast, I went back and I was like, okay, which issues are my letters? Because I, contrary to what you may think of me, I don't have them framed on my wall or anything like that. I have to go through my long boxes and say,
part of a PowerPoint presentation.
Commented on that one. Which would that have been? This one, maybe this one. Oh, it's the one with Aquaman and Red Tornado by Perez on the cover. Score. So yeah, I was happy that was that one.
Yeah. Are you kidding? That's amazing stuff. I would love to have done that. Except the closest I ever got is my name is printed in JLA number 250. Because they used to do that thing where near the mid-80s, they would be like, we didn't print these letters, but here's everybody that wrote in. And they would just list names. No, yeah. I guess they wanted to give everybody, you know, a little bit of a, and I'm the first name in that list in JLA number 250. That was the closest I ever got. So,
well, there good you go.
Yeah, there we go. So don't be sarcastic with me, Russell. So,
I had a printed in 30 years. So it's, I was a child. What's the word I want?
Prodigy.
Prodigy. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I was a prodigy. I haven't done anything worthwhile in the last 40 years.
Well, hey, you know, you burned early and then you flashed early and then burned out, but that's fine. So, well, Russell, you called this issue, I think like 2 months into my creation of this show, which was right. 3 years ago. And so we've been waiting to get to this one. So, you know, finally we're here. And again, it's very impressive. So thank you for coming back to the show. I appreciate it.
I love talking about it. It's one of my all-time favorite comic book issues.
Absolutely. So where can people find you out on the internet?
Well, gosh, I'm sort of stuck in the limbo right now. I'm not really anywhere on the internet. I got the Legion of Superheroes blog. I can't even think of the name of it. Legion of Super Bloggers. But we haven't updated that lately because there's no Legion of Superheroes comic. So that's
a bit of a problem.
Yeah, kind of a problem. No source material. Other than that, I'm busy at home working on my fan fiction, my Justice League stories that I should be posting on my Segi no Nakama, which is Japanese for Super Friends. That's my blog. And I will, I think there's a little hyperlink on your page for that if people want to check it out. I write and draw my own Justice League stories. In fact, I actually took this story as a base and swapped the bad guy out to be the Psycho Pirate, which doesn't quite work because the Psycho Pirate's a little bit different power wise, but I still kind of just used it in the same way.
I can see it. Yeah, I can see it.
It was okay. I mean, it was basically the story with the bunch of superheroes, Justice Leaguers instead of the Super Friends. So it was, I like it, but
yeah, it works. Psycho Pirate, another villain from that JLA JSA team up. Yeah, that's good stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, well, again, Russell, thank you so much for coming back and thank you all for listening. I want you to stay tuned. I'm going to run some commercial announcements and when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Lucky's cornered.
We'll get it, Lucky Charms, this time.
Time? That's it. I'll make a time tunnel and go back in time with me, Lucky Charms. A crunchy old cereal with a rainbow of marshmallow surprises. Pink hearts, orange stars, yellow moons, green clovers, blue diamonds, and purple horseshoes. Time sure fly, yikes! Yeah. Ouch, boots, eat, ouch! Guess the time ran out. Frosted Lucky Charms, a historic part of this nutritious breakfast.
Ooga, mega, mega, diga.
Superman Radio Revisited, hosted by Matthew T. Cody. This is going to be a new podcast which will be exploring the Superman radio show of the 1940s. It will begin by playing an episode.
Unfiltered, unedited, uncensored.
Uncut. Followed by my commentary. We're going to talk about the era a little bit and any interesting things that crop up in the episodes. I think it'll be a lot of fun, and I'm hoping to make it an interactive show. So come along. It's going to be a great time.
And it's time for listener feedback, and these are the comments we got on For All Mankind, episode 39, with my guest, Devin Clancy. First up is Brian Schufo, who says, the highlight of this insane issue was showing Aquaman working with Zan and Jaina. It wasn't integral to the story, but it made for a nice transition when Batman and Robin were walking in instead of everyone just sitting around. That is often what we see, Brian. I did like that extra detail of, hey, we're doing some training in the downtime here. Edo Boznar says, since it came up, I recall waking up quite early on Saturday mornings to watch cartoons, like before 7 a.m. sometimes. Yes, there were cartoons on that early, but I'm pretty sure they were syndicated reruns presented by the local affiliate. I specifically remember catching cartoons from earlier years in that time slot. I think the official network cartoons started at 8 a.m. Good show otherwise. Devin is a fine guest. I also enjoyed his digressions. And now I'm thinking there's another reason why it's too bad there's less than a year's worth of these Super Friends issues left. Devin, you'll just have to find a way to appear on one of Rob's 19 other shows on the network. I see what you did there, you know. But yes, that's true. Devin could appear in any of the other shows. Martin Gray says, thanks for a great episode, Rob and Devin. As one of the many massive Overlord fans, I love this issue. And yes, this was definitely one of the best Super Friends covers, if not the best. I don't think that comic cover Bats's reading represented any particular mystery in space, as none of them seem to have had boxed cover images. Funnily enough, there was a Super Friends Mystery in Space comic published decades later in 2010. It's really clever, Overlord being inspired by one of Superman's nicknames, Man of Tomorrow. If you'd been thinking Last Son of Krypton, there had been no clones. Check out page 15. Panel 4 is Kibitzer. Is that really a word Aquaman would use? Good on Jerry Serpe by page 11. He's apparently so sick of the lack of backgrounds, thank you, Vince Coletta, that he's adding interest with bursts of color. He seems to have saved all of his energy for the backup. Maybe he was into discos. Regarding said backup, I like the Wonder Twins getting more creative with their powers. Shocking to see bollocks used by one of the hoods on page 7. We now know he means bollocks. How rude. Yeah, another compliment for Jerry Serpe. I often overlook the colorists in these comics, and Jerry Serpe gets mentioned twice this episode, so good for him. Deserves it. I don't mean to overlook the letterer and the colorist. They are integral parts of any comic book, but I just tend to focus on the writer, penciler, and inker, and then we move on. Sean M. Myers from this very network says, hello, Devin. Welcome to the podcast. You were great. Hearing you talk about not knowing different comic book artists remind me that when I first started getting comics and read letters pages, I would hear people talk about different artists and their art styles. In the beginning, I couldn't tell the difference between the artists at all. I remember distinctly, however, when I started to read The Flash, it was drawn by Don Heck. A few issues in, the book went to 50 cents and they added a backup featuring Firestorm, drawn by George Perez. That taught me how different two comic book artists could be. For the Wonder Twin stories, I think instead of the title, The Boogie Mania Will Get You, should have been called The Boogie Mafia Will Get You. Hearing you talk about not serving alcohol to teens and how the club would go out of business made me think back of all the times when I used to go to the under 21 clubs and pay a cover charge of $5, $10, $15, sometimes even $20 to get in. That's the answer to how they made their money. I didn't go to clubs as a kid, but I never even heard of under 21 clubs. So that's a fascinating idea. That was even a thing, Sean. Dr. Ann says, I didn't have this one, so great to hear about it and read it. The Overlord is insane. If your Cheerio is a bit awkward looking, I can't wait to see how the Overlord saga ends. A few more comments. Aquaman swimming in Zan is weird. I hope Zan doesn't ever feel a part of his pool, suddenly feel warmer. Brr. I actually like the Wonder Twins story more, if only for the nostalgia of the disco craze in America. Check out all the background details and dancers. Vince Coletta must love Donna Summer for him to put in all that effort. The disco itself looks like it should have been called the Ditko Disco with all those decorations. Looks like a nightmare dimension. And great to hear Devin. Hope you hear him on other shows on the network. You hear that, Devin? Paul Wildenberger says, love the episode. Devin was a great guest, and I hope to hear him on more Fire and Water shows. Another vote for you, Devin. Back on your episode regarding issue 24, I commented how he must have had that issue as a child, because I had memories and certain panels and lines of dialogue. Just yesterday, I came across a box of old comics tucked in amongst issues of Little Archie, Archie's Joke Book, Jughead, and Richie Rich. Richie Rich, you were the one, Paul, were three issues of Super Friends, specifically issues 24, 42, and the last issue, 47. I know I had a few issues back in the day, and it was awesome to find them again. Now I will be sure to read them before you cover them, Rob. Cool, Paul. Thank you very much. Bucky 749 says, great show, great guest. Have to say Zan should maybe get in some boxing training from Wildcat. Also, how come we never see Ace or Crypto in the Super Friends? That's a fine question, Bucky. They seem like characters that ENB would be kind of maybe predisposed to working in. They're part of the lore, and they're kind of fun and childlike. Kids like animals, especially dogs. So that would make sense. Chris Franklin, of course, from this network and been on the show a bunch of times, says, Devin brought up some great points on for discussion, such as, does the Super Friends comic take place on Earth 1? Well, ENB thought it did, but I think he was really the only one. I think someone asked Barbara Zakas this in an Ask the Answer Man column, and I believe he cheekily said it took place on Earth 1A. That's how I look at it. All the events in the Earth 1 continuity happen on the Super Friends reality, but the Super Friends team, the Wonder Twins, etc., don't really exist in the proper Earth 1 continuity, for the most part. But then you have Superman knowing the Global Guardians when he teams with them, etc. New Teen Titans does seem to be where the real divide begins. It's hard to imagine Mona Frayne's Robin waking up shirtless in his pajama bottoms while Starfire is in his PJ shirt. As I've gotten older and the DC Universe has become the incomprehensible mess it is, the more I think hyper time is the answer. It's all real unless you don't want it to be. Wise words. Robert J. Smith. Geez, Bob Smith, the anchor from this company. No. Says, words of the wise. Ollie is selling DC omnibuses. I picked up Super Friends Volume 2 this morning, so I'm all set through the end of this podcast, although I hope Rod finds some way to extend it. I hate it when a good podcast ends. Thank you, Robert. I very much appreciate the comment. And I will say, it won't end at 47 just because that's the last issue. There will be a couple other bonus shows that we're going to do to round the show off at a nice even 50. I feel like that's a good place to stop. So there will be a couple of months past the end of the Super Friends title proper. Captain Entropy says, I've been waiting so long for the return of Overlord and the appearance of Futurio. This comic is where I learned about the noble gases. Krypton was a word before Siegel and Schuster. My mind was blown. Anyway, this was a great episode. Robin Devon, worthy of what I remember as epic material. As far as the consistency of Robin's characterization, I think I've mentioned before that my older brother was a teenager when I was reading these. He seemed to scale up or down in age or sophistication, depending on expectations. He was a leader with his friends and a very junior partner with our dad. But if he was hanging out with me, he might lay on the floor and watch TV. So I never saw any discontinuity with Robin. Eagerly awaiting Futurio's Future Bros. That's really neat. Observation, Captain, about your brother. I hadn't experienced that myself. I have an older brother, but that really wasn't what I lived through. So that's interesting. You could compare him to Robin like that. And then Captain Entropy adds one more comment. He says, oh, and I'm super pleased that our conversation last month was so well received. Thanks for letting me play and especially for inviting Henry. I wish you had added your comments in with the feedback, Rob. Believe it or not, you're actually the talent here. We like you and your opinion is interesting to us. It's even true of Shag, but we all make sure not to tell him. Brett Young says, great show, Rob and Devin. What a great issue for any kid who was really into pages and pages of scientists in her monologue. I know that's what I'm looking for to comment. I'm not sure why Overlord works out of a futuristic laundromat, but at least this way he can clean his fuzzy cape while he's growing evil babies. It's a bummer Congress won't fund his research, but fear not, Overlord. I'm sure that money is earmarked for plenty of other villainous plans. The Aquaman training session with Greg and Marcia Brady was certainly different. When swimming inside one of your teammates, maybe, quote, can you pick up my thoughts, isn't the best thing to say in a kid's comic. I've already harped on all of Justice Security in the past, but come on, Super Friends. You can't let HGH Vincent Price just stroll right in and dog walk all five of you without at least an alarm going off. The modern doorbell is safer. And then he does it again. This 12 feet tall guy just walks right into the parking lot and back inside the HQ. By the way, whose cars are in the parking lot? I think everyone has their own ride. Does Aquaman drive to work? And did the Super Friends just casually kill Futurio? It's a little ambiguous, but did they remove his ability to breathe? And how will they dispose of a body that big? A form of an ice axe and a giant vulture. I don't have much to say about that Hansel and Gretel backup story. You're killing me, Brett. Other than when I was in high school, there was an under 21 dance club, another one in Lancaster, PA called Rick's Place. It was pretty cheesy, but I asked a lot of girls to dance there with varying results. I definitely owe Rick's Place for overcoming my fear of rejection. I have got to hear more about these under 21 clubs. You and Sean Myers about to get together on some podcast, Brett. And then finally got a comment from Cellar Dweller, aka Chuck, who says, many thanks to Rob and Devin on this episode. Issue number 47 is looming, and I'm going to miss this podcast once it's over. Regarding the Earth One debate, I was always in the camp of Super Friends is Earth One continuity, and I've run into other comic fans online who shared that opinion, so it's more than prevalent than most would believe. It's funny how you can revisit something from your childhood and realize all the things you overlooked. I remember liking this issue as a kid, but rereading it for this podcast, I realized what Rob and Devin had mentioned, how many elements could have been their own story and how it was all crammed into one. So Overlord can clone, advance the clones by centuries, and age them rapidly. Someone like this could give Lex Luthor an inferiority complex. Interesting to hear you both enjoy Zan's attempt to take on Futurio. I thought it was rather stupid. A teen boy, unpowered, going after someone in a physical manner who had defeated Superman, Wonder Woman, and Aquaman. While seeing Aquaman and Jaina swimming in Zan was weird, I did like seeing the twins getting a training session with a senior hero. The Wonder Twins solo was a fave for me, just to see how the twins related to each other and other teens. One suggestion I had I'd seen made a few times in the letter column, but was never followed up on, was to have other teen heroes make guest appearances in the Wonder Twins stories. I wish that had happened. See you next month. Thank you so much, Chuck. Yeah, it would have been cool to have Wendy and Marvin show up in the Wonder Twins backup. I know Chris Franklin would hate that, but I think that would have been kind of neat, but they never got around to doing that. I guess maybe when you've only got 8 pages, you don't have a ton of space, although they made room for another elf in this story with Jack-O-Lantern, but let's leave that aside. So that's it for this episode of For All Mankind. Big thanks to my pal Russell Berger coming back. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of this show on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. We're always talking Super Friends over on Twitter at For All Mankind SF. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. And then finally, if you want to support the Find Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast, and there you're going to unlock various rewards, one of which is through name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Gord Tolton, David Escudieras, Chuck Dill, and Stanford M. Brown for their support of the network. Really appreciate it. So as I said, that's it. Thanks for listening to For All Mankind. Join us next episode when we will look at Super Friends number 41, The Toy Man's Tricky Thefts.
An FW TV podcast.